Welcome to Love Hate Automate, the podcast where digital dreams dress tomorrow's reality. I'm your host, Dale Parr, and with my weekly guests, we'll be diving into the vibrant world of digital fashion. Each episode, we stitch together innovation, creativity, and a splash of the unexpected. This week, we're delving into the world of transformation and circularity with a very special guest. A former CSR director at PVH, Sasha knows her way around this topic very, very well, and she is now leading an initiative called Future Proof Fashion. Allow me to welcome Sasha McFarlane to the show.
Thank you, Dale. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us and to share your love, hate, automate. But before we go into that, please go ahead, introduce yourself to our audience.
Sure. Yeah. I'll keep it short and sweet, but I have been in the fashion industry now for, almost 20 years. Started on the shop floor and moved into buying and merchandising roles as kind of my first segue into big corporate brands and retailers, which is where I started to get an understanding of some of the foundational business models and how severely flawed they were. When in buying meetings, we were congratulated for 70% sell-throughs on some of our products. And so started the quest to really understand how we got to where we got. So I moved more into strategic roles from that point on, kind of leaving behind more of the creative, pretty side of fashion, and really started to dig into the go-to-market process in general. So I was given the opportunity to support some businesses back over in the U.S. on really digging into their entire go-to-market process from start to finish. It was about an 18-month piece of work interviewing every player across the entire value chain to understand the value and role that they played. And where we really started to uncover the complexity that was causing some of the disruption that we were seeing, certainly in terms of being able to get faster and more reactive in our supply chain. My final role, I would say, within the big brand and corporate world was with PVH. So I was the on the value chain of the future team. And we were essentially given the task of looking into the future. We were firewalled from the rest of the business and allowed to think and ponder about what the world would look like 5 to 10 years from now. Amazing. And how would we as businesses thrive in that future state? Probably one of the best positions to have, certainly in the amount of volatility and disruption that we're feeling within our industry today. Just great to be able to get out there and start to look at some of the trends that were happening and start to get some predictions, talk to startups, understand, who the biggest and fastest movers were out there. So just a fantastic role to be in, which really inspired Future Proof Fashion. So I now am the executive director of Future Proof Fashion. We started the business just about a year ago now. Really to take that value chain of the future team concept and apply it to the entire industry, knowing that the majority of the issues that we saw and forecasted were too big for one individual player to tackle on their own. Yeah. And so bringing together groups of consortium partnerships was really the only way that we were going to get the investment and the scale needed in order to drive some of that transformation that we were looking at. And again, I can talk about some of the projects that we specifically work on, but our expertise is to govern those multi-stakeholder complex industry scale and very long-term ROI projects. That's me.
Incredible. Future foresighting is something that I've dabbled in as well, kind of the Institute of the Futures in San Francisco. I've done some of their webinars and some of their courses just about how to, articulate your mind to kind of think in a way that drops the barriers and drops all the familiarities of what you know today and allows you to see the world in a different context 10 years ahead. So it's really refreshing, isn't it, to be able to kind of think in that way.
It's a very unique thing, especially in a corporate environment. And in fact, when we speak to specific businesses and support specific businesses, they always ask us how they incentivize that type of behavior internally. And my answer is, it's next to impossible. If you're linked to any type of, you know, corporate business that has to deliver a quarter or a year, and that's really the mechanism for success and measurement of success within some of these big corporations, it's next to impossible to incentivize and protect a group to really think like that. So yeah, it was very unique, I think, to have that at PBH. I think more businesses should certainly now look to incentivize that type of behavior. But again, it takes a very different profile of a person who can do that. And they must be segmented away from the daily business. Because again, I just don't think it works when someone is linked to delivering again on a quarter or, you know, 6 month, a year timeframe. That time horizon doesn't work for any of this future looking solution building and strategic thinking. It's got to be thought about very differently.
Yeah, I agree. But I think that equation for success is an interesting one as well, because, you know, there are so many facets within a business that lead to long-term legacy and ultimate success as a value of kind of margin or profitability. It takes a whole mix, and innovation is very much part of that. And I think that sometimes it's underestimated or is seen in the wrong light or as a cost center rather than investment into the future. So I think that success equation is a really, really interesting topic. But instead of digressing on that, let's get into the main body of the show. So what would be your love this week?
So my love, just coming from the background that I do, I love to see some of these disruptors who are probably getting at the moment slightly negative press, attention. We read about them, and I'll name a few: Shein, Temu, in general, the creator economy. And, you know, I always have to caveat what I say with I don't necessarily advocate for all of the practices within these businesses. However, proving that the term fast fashion isn't what is bad about the fashion industry. Being fast is not what is wrong with us. And again, I alluded to kind of uncovering that dirty truth within our industry very early on in my career. Because of how slow we are, we have to make big bets and take big gambles on what we end up producing. And so that 70% sell-through is pretty typical of a big brand or retailer that has to place orders at least 6 months in advance from when those orders will arrive. If we can get faster, we can get more accurate. And so seeing that happen through the likes of Shein, who I think is probably the biggest, most successful disruptor out there right now, is quite refreshing to see. Now, I think thinking about how we do that in a much more sustainable way, so disincentivizing overconsumption, but actually moving to that mindset of just-in-time manufacturing for quality, sustainably made garments, the melding of those two themes needs to happen. Mm. But I love seeing the case proven for becoming faster. And again, we'll talk about, you know, the technology that's really enabling that. But some of that disruption that's happening on the front end, and certainly where the demand is coming from, speaks volumes. And I think it's really flipping the industry on its head. You know, we talk to a lot of technology companies, startups, and they talk about gaining access into some of the behemoth, you know, big brands that are out there today. And I tend to push back on them. You know, certainly these smaller startups who are probably not going to reach scale for the next few years in terms of their solution for those who make it, but rather start to focus on some of these new players. And the stories are, you know, old as time in that regard. You think about Blockbuster and Netflix and that story where Netflix tried to sell, you know, to Blockbuster, and they just weren't interested. But that sigmoid curve of success and, you know, decline within a business has happened forever and ever, and will forever and ever happen to every business that is out there. And so now we start to see those disruptors come, disrupting the status quo and proving a different model of operating. I guess the question is, can the other big players really change themselves, you know, quickly enough? We see that disruption really starting to shake the likes of H&M. So H&M being one of the big, strong, you know, performers for the past 10, 20 years. I mean, I am a, you know, avid shopper of H&M myself. But you start to see Shein referenced as the reason for some of the issues that they're facing today. Nike, another one, Nike, who have or are still, you know, seen as kind of one of the key leads in the fashion industry. They're massive, making announcements in their December earnings call that they're taking $2 billion out of overhead costs to look at reinvesting into, you know, the mechanisms that allow them to become more reactive, to match that new status quo. Whether they can do that in time, let's see. But yeah, love that disruption. Love seeing that being proven time and time again.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, isn't it? It's definitely going to be the high street players that suffer from Shein's core business model, because the luxury houses will just do what they do, and because they're so financially resilient and have so much influence, they can afford to keep it in the traditional quite slow lane, can't they? You know, but yeah, in the highly competitive world that we see with the Primarks and the H&Ms, that speed to market and that closeness to their customer, and the disruption that culture through social media brings, Shein just have the digital strategies to Shein and Temu and the others have that signal detection system really well refined at the moment.
Exactly. And, you know, I think these are the notes that we need to take as an industry on what are the good parts of that. And again, this is no secret. I think everyone who has spoken to me over the past few years probably knows this, but we did a piece of research on Shein when Shein kind of started to pop up everywhere. And again, the what was being said about them was oftentimes pretty negative. And when I started my research, the goal was to get the learnings on how badly they were doing, to go internally as a, let's make sure we don't do any of this, you know, lesson learned, you know, we understand what's happening out there, but we do not want to emulate this business model. And in fact, going through that research, I uncovered the truth that they had really enabled this ability to understand that demand signal so closely and only produce what was needed when it was needed better than any other company out there. And so I ended up flipping the research on its head and taking that internally to present it to say, we need to become more like Shein. On this specific aspect, we need to start looking at how we solve that issue. It's an interesting one. It's certainly a controversial one, but that term fast fashion, I think we definitely need to think about how we rephrase that to become more appropriate. Disposable fashion, you know, unsustainable fashion. I'm all for, you know, those terms being used to describe these types of businesses, but the fast part, certainly not the issue.
The solution. Without getting too much into the weeds, do you know where they get their, how they do their sentiment analysis? Because I know for a fact it's difficult to scrape Twitter and social media platforms in Europe. The ones we use in Europe anyway. But obviously WeChat in China is probably a different proposition. And China are known as being the most AI advanced nation, with facial recognition and all the signal detections they use for card transactions, sentiment analysis through WeChat. I was just curious whether you knew kind of where they, you know, what part of the digital touch point they were really, really focused on.
So what I can say, what I know of Shein, is their model is purely a test and chase model. So Shein do not bulk produce until they know they have a hit with the consumer. A lot of the times they won't even physically produce an item. So it'll be a digital version put up on the website. And until they secure enough orders, they will not produce that item. And so again, goes back to kind of the way that they're publicly perceived, you know, being spoken about that they list 6,000 styles a day. Well, 6,000 styles a day, when they're producing really only half of those probably are going into production. And of those, it's maybe 50 units to 100 units per style. So the amount of variety that they're getting in front of the consumer and actually allowing their website to be where they scrape that data from directly is huge. Now, of course, on the controversial side, they have what you would, I think what they call internally as designers, when in fact those designers are actually out there looking for trends. And that could be anywhere from on social media, looking at what's trending, but it could also be from within local boutiques. So if you look actually at where these designers are located, they're all across the globe, dispersed across the globe, you know, certainly in any of their markets, large markets. And so these designers really play that role of scraper, not just from a digital aspect, but also an in-person, almost like that secret, you know, old school secret shopper mentality that they used to have. So, and this is where you'll see a lot of the controversy around some, you know, some local boutique who had a design knocked off by Shein. How could that be possible? It wasn't even listed on their website. Well, this is how they're doing it. So, but really that test and chase model is what is winning. They are not producing until they know that they have a hit. And that's really the thing to be extracted from this and emulated across all of the other brands. Again, question mark on whether they can do it.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating topic, Shein, for sure. But let's move on to hate or frustrate, or you know, what challenge or controversy is in the front and center for you at the moment?
Yeah. So this is very topical today. And I know, Dale, when you and I first talked about this, this topic remains consistent from what we talked about a few weeks ago, but actually couldn't be more topical today than, you know, than when we spoke originally about it 2 weeks ago, because we found out that Renewcell, unfortunately, is filing for bankruptcy. So Renewcell have kind of been seen as at the forefront of scaled textile recycling. And unfortunately, it was announced today, you know, publicly that they are going to file for bankruptcy. So this has been a huge or sent shockwaves, I think, through the industry. If you look at all the responses and the outpouring of sadness from, you know, the sustainability community on really what this signals, it's pretty heartbreaking. And to be quite honest, it's pretty shameful that we allowed this to happen as an industry. I don't think it was any secret that they were struggling. I think they were pretty open and public about, you know, the issues that they were facing. And so my hate remains consistent and is even louder today. But the disparity in support and, let's say, the fragmentation that currently exists for end-of-life support in the fashion industry, we will never get to a scaled, profitable, viable solution unless there is some type of collaborative effort from within the industry. Meaning, Renewcell as the example, right? And hopefully this doesn't come out too closely to that, you know, that story. But I think the example of Renewcell is that they had their recycling capability within the founder's original country.
Yeah.
What they produced, exactly. And what they produced was a pulp. That pulp then gets sent over primarily, and I think at this point they probably have a bigger network, but primarily that was going into China to be turned into fibers and threads and then cut and sewn into garments eventually. That entire process, because that product was seen as a premium, there were premiums being tacked on at every step of the way, because we thought, right, as an industry, we would pay a premium for that type of product. And that's just not the case. And we've seen this now crash and burn because of that, that happening. But the fragmentation within that end of life supply chain is never going to get us to a point where we have unit economics that actually work mm-hmm. for the industry. So, and this is specifically one of the projects that we work on. And the vision of that project is to co-locate all of the best recycling technology that currently exists today, but also to create some type of center of excellence to incubate technology on the cusp of becoming commercial scale, to really allow for a fully circular vertical supply chain to actually be created and scaled. And again, you know, some of the big issues is that fragmentation, but cost being another one. And that's we're never going to get past this when every single textile recycler is trying to figure out a way to automate shredding or remove trims or sort. There's a leverage that can be a leverage of support that can actually help to scale this in a faster way and acquire the right technology, grow and scale that, and get the investment needed to grow and scale that. But that doesn't happen unless we have some type of, center of excellence that can be seen as that original blueprint to, again, build and scale it, and then hopefully duplicate those across the globe. But again, that disparity that we're seeing there, it's no surprise. And something that we do at Future Proof Fashion is we like to look at the sentiment from within the industry, knowing that there's a lot of marketing that goes out in front of the general public around sustainability and hitting targets. We like to dig into any of their public-facing discussions around, so earnings call transcripts, right? We love to dig through a transcript and understand how many times did they talk about things like sustainability or, mm-hmm. Carbon emissions, and how did they talk about it? How did they talk about investing in that type of thing? And probably to no surprise, it's very rarely mentioned. And if it is, it's maybe a question, something about a new strategy that they've got, but very little meaningful, substantial sustainability work ever mentioned in any of these earnings call transcripts. And again, I think it just sends a clear signal that this isn't something that businesses are going to voluntarily do. So this is where something like legislation needs to level that playing field for all of the players out there to incentivize them to support in figuring out ways to scale end-of-life support, as well as many other initiatives that need to happen from reduced overproduction all the way through to the end.
It is interesting that H&M are actually a majority shareholder.
Exactly.
And so why? I'm sure they have been propping them up, and I'm sure there'll be some, complex commercial issues internally that we just don't fully understand. But they are very much could be part of the solution there. But then you hear things like it was Stuart Vavers from Coach last week says sustainability has to come from the designers, which I think is, again, it's throwing designers under the bus a little bit, because its sustainability is a responsibility for a business, not one single department or entity or individual. Sustainability should be like nutrition in food. Well, it's a parallel anyway. So a good quality producer of food or ingredients naturally has high nutrition value. Luxury businesses should, just by order of what they do, should have high sustainability values in the same way. Low-grade food, you get what you get. The same with low-grade fashion, you kind of get what you get. I think sustainability is framed, it's viewed in through the wrong lens. It should just be a pathway that every brand walks rather than being an end goal. And it's probably, again, part of that equation for success. It's like, how resources are utilized, how waste is dealt with, are again part of that being successful. All of that leads to a more efficient business, ultimately should be a better financial outcome for the business as well if it's engaged with. But I think you've kind of alluded to the fact a couple of times is that everyone's too focused on the quarter to be thinking beyond.
Yeah.
And that's probably a fundamental issue.
100%. I mean, if you think about, and I say this a lot, right? No CEO has ever lost their job because they didn't meet a sustainability target, but they oftentimes lose their job for not meeting financial targets. The lifespan of a CEO today in some of these Fortune 500 companies is so short that implementing anything that actually delivers transformation within that business operation is so unlikely. Really, this is where I, you know, going back to the reference of the guidance that we give some of these startups who aren't probably going to get to any type of scale over the next few years, is focus on the new, focus on who the new disruptive players are, because those are the business models you will need to service moving forward, rather than focusing on serving some of these other businesses who either need to change their business model in order to survive going forward, or maybe don't make it across that burning bridge that they're currently standing on because they aren't able to change their business model. And again, that happens, right? It's the circle of life for businesses. The new, you know, kind of appear and gain success, and that's it. That's the way that it happens. But kind of watching that all happen and the issues being perpetuated because of how these businesses are incentivized. That's just never going to change. And again, I think governments are trying to unplug that or help to level that playing field and disincentivize them by including things like carbon taxes, right? So if a carbon tax was slapped on Shein, as was proposed last week in France, that would completely destroy Shein's business in France. They financially would not be able to sell at the price point that they market themselves as. So there is legislation that I think will start to force the hand of change. It's probably not strong enough and not at a global level to disincentivize again what's kind of been allowed to happen for the past 50 to 100 years. That's what we're trying to change. That's what those pathways that have been entrenched so deeply, that's what we're trying to change and move away from. And again, this is where I look to the new guys and congratulate them for being able to disrupt it severely enough that it is starting to get attention and momentum. And again, if we can find a way to kind of meet those worlds in the middle where we are, we see those disruptors operating, match it to some of the more sustainable behaviors and support that in getting to a more, economically feasible, sustainable, whether it's materials, design processes, recycling for end-of-life support, whatever that may be. But I believe we are going to get there. I just don't see it happening without us really bringing that strong collaboration from the industry. And sometimes it takes things like the news today of RenewCell to wake people up and make them realize that we're just never going to get ourselves out of this spiral if we don't think about how to do something differently.
Brands with a 50, 60, 80, 100 year heritage will have no legacy if they don't adapt. Like you say, they won't cross that bridge, and that will be the end. And I suppose that will become naturally to some businesses, as, like you say, as is the case. But it's such a shame to think that, short-termism and CEOs aren't prepared to work in progressive ways, shall we say. So let's move on to automate. Technology or solution, or, what problem are you aware of that you would love to discover somebody building a solution for that? Or perhaps there is a solution that's in the proof of concept stage that you've seen that you find really, really exciting.
Yeah, so this kind of underlines probably a lot of what we've already spoken about. But where I see the biggest opportunity for our industry outside of textile recycling, which, is kind of moving again, bad news this week on that. But the big opportunity that I see is to automate the front end production planning mm-hmm. capabilities. And this would solve a huge amount of issues within from a profit point of view and from a sustainability point of view for some of those big global brands. And what I mean by that is our internal planning processes within a traditional global retailer today are incredibly outdated. Yeah. And for managing, you know, thousands and thousands of SKUs are done in Excel forms, are passed from planner to, you know, supply chain partners. It could be via PDFs, could be via emails. It's very antiquated. And so I often bring in the story here around looking at what's happening and that disruption that's happening within fashion demand today. The volatility has increased significantly, and this is all down to things like the creator economy or the access and ability for micro trends to pop up and kind of phase in and phase out. And so you think about some of these traditional players who work on an 18-month go-to-market calendar, mm-hmm. Who again are then expected to place orders, let's say 6 months in advance, maybe if they have a more reactive, you know, capability, a few months in advance. But still, when you think about what's happening in the market today and how quickly TikTok trends go in and out and, you know, the attention yeah. of the general consumer is what, 10, 20 seconds on a TikTok video. It's very hard to get that right. And so, again, referencing the 70% sell through and being congratulated for that and the other 30% being burned or buried. And so when I look at other industries, right, aviation is probably the best example of this. Aviation adopted AI many, many years ago, before we had ever heard of ChatGPT. When you get on a commercial flight, about 70% of the time that flight is in the air, it's typically on autopilot. That yeah. autopilot is able to interpret information to keep the flight or the plane as steady as possible through turbulence, to be able to ensure fuel efficiency needed, certainly for some of these long haul flights. And so that interpretation of data and the automation of how to keep the plane on track, how much fuel to use, how fast to go, is all being made by a computer. Yet we haven't been able to implement that same thinking into the fashion industry, right? Mm-hmm. And the only assumption here is that, you know, our executive advisor tends to call it the tragedy of the horizon. Because the implications of overproduction don't necessarily impact us instantaneously, we can't interpret how damaging that is instantaneously, unlike in the aviation industry, where if something goes wrong on a plane, it could be pretty catastrophic pretty yeah, quickly. Yeah. And so the incentive to bring in technology like AI and to automate some of that is obviously very evident. In the fashion industry, we just don't have that. We haven't had that incentive. And so the biggest opportunity for automation currently today within the industry is automated planning. And that we kind of term as multidimensional planning capabilities. There are a couple of companies out there who are, I would say, closest to delivering on a solution like this. But I would say the biggest question, again, is whether the brands can actually change. Think about the tech stack of a traditional mm-hmm. brand today. It's huge. And they've got legacy systems and processes that are incredibly complex. So to unplug that and plug it into an autopilot for planning, it's a pretty big ask, believe it or not.
So would this be part of a PLM system or would it be in addition to?
Yeah, it would be part of it. So all of it needs to be integrated. And I think this yeah. is another big big reason that integrating solutions like this is so complex, because the systems that are used and the information that is data integrity in general within the fashion yeah. industry isn't the best. And so implementing solutions like this, there is no consistency for even a PLM platform, right? Or the data and how it's interpreted within the PLM platform.
Would this be a virtual assistant that could kind of, you know, it could be aggregating data from, you know, Lectra, for example, and Shopify and some POS if there happens to be an omni-channel business, and it would be somehow learning and aggregating and analyzing this data and then pushing it into some range planning for, you know, short term.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. And so if you think about, so not only that, not only being able to interpret demand in a more autonomous and real time manner, but then being able to have a reactive supply chain. And, you know, we kind of talk about the big ones, right? COVID, shipping delays because ships are stuck in, you know, canals and port closures, wars, that are happening all across the globe, these disruptions, and these are just some of the big ones, right? There are disruptions that happen like this, especially because of the fragmentation and current fashion supply chains today, that really have a massive impact. And right now we manage these pretty much through email or, you know, updates within, VMS systems that again are very outdated, very antiquated, and allow for very little reaction. So great that we know this information happened, but then what? What's the next best solution? And how do we have a tool that helps advise us on the next best solution? So allowing for a continuous flow of real-time information on disruption through the supply chain, or let's say opportunity through the supply chain, to optimize production to best match demand, whatever that may look like, whether it's on a white t-shirt, whether it's on a, you know, floral print dress and you only produce once you actually have an order, whatever it may be, that the business is allowed to set parameters for what the expected profitability of that garment or, you know, program is, and that you allow the tool to then autonomously decide where something should be produced. Now, a lot of, you know, where we get pushback on this when we talk to brands is that IMU, so initial markup, is one of the KPIs that a buyer, for example, would be incentivized on. Yeah. So making sure that they buy, you know, MOQs that allow them to get to a certain IMU is very important. Yeah. But if you actually look at the degradation of that IMU through the process, so being, you know, having to store inventory in a warehouse because you don't have, you know, reactive capabilities, but then because you had to order, you know, way out from your actual demand signal, you've overproduced by 30%, let's say. Mm-hmm. And so now you have to mark down. So that eats into your profit. Now you have to liquidate. That eats into your profit. There's a whole life cycle after the calculation of the IMU that happens that actually takes into account the profit, which essentially is what a company needs to do is make a profit. And so moving to a more autonomous planning capability allows you to now incentivize for profit-driven decision-making versus some of this, it's almost alternate thinking, right? You almost do, it incentivizes behaviors that go against profitability and sustainability because of the way KPIs and metrics have been set up and disseminated internally within the industry. And it's pretty standard across most of the big players. You'll see this consistently, but that is a huge opportunity to bring in automation.
Just out of interest, do you imagine the range planning to be essentially the autonomous system would say, we need 40 heavyweight jersey pieces for this particular collection. This is the factory. What about the design and product development of that? Is it just going to be is it going to be predicting SKUs and product categories, or is it going to be doing more? Is it going to be effectively designing, rendering as well? How do you imagine it?
So I think the scale and the breadth of this could absolutely be an, let's say, almost an autonomous brand. You know, you kind of feed in what that brand's DNA is, and you allow for complete autonomy in terms of design, production. And so the limits are theoretically endless. However, I think that in order to, so you need those players, right? And that again, probably is more of the Shein model. Shein doesn't actually set the trends. They just take advantage of the trends.
Yeah.
So if you go, I'll use Tommy Hilfiger as an example, you know, if you look at the men's landing page of Shein, typically you will find a Tommy Hilfiger knockoff. Mm-hmm. Very similar item. Someone needs to set that trend, right? There still needs to be that authentic, let's say, design. And you were talking, you know, earlier about the luxury market. That's really the role of these higher end luxury mm-hmm. players, is to set the trends. They are the trend setters. And so within that, you still have to have this authentic, let's say, purely artistic capability. Now, that may be supported through AI capabilities, for sure, you know, no doubt. But that is very much still human touch that supports that, in my mind. As you kind of go further down the chain in terms of players, and those who are looking to take advantage and are more opportunistic on some of the trends that have been driven from the top down, then yes, of course, you could kind of get all the way into fully autonomous design as well. So yeah, I think it's an exciting time to see what could come out of this. And I'm sure there are people out there, you know, creating fully autonomous brands today, and I cannot wait to see how that disrupts. But I think there will always be a place for, who is it? The guy, gosh, I can't remember what his name is. Ruben something. And he's got a great quote. It's on TikTok and I see it often. You know, people post it often, but he talks about true art. And if you make something that you love as the artist, that's true art. Versus if you're making something that you think the mass consumer will like, that's not art anymore. That's consumerism, right? You're trying to, you're building a, it's like the algorithm, you know, from Netflix. Like, you'll see some of these yeah. shows and you're like, it's an algorithm, you know, it's a very clear process that they kind of went through. Here's who the main character should be, and here's how the story should flow, and same kind of thing. There are algorithms, and yes, they can be successful. But true art, I think, is still very much a part of the ecosystem in the fashion industry, and will probably stay at that luxury level, but, definitely still a part in my mind.
Yeah, I think you're paraphrasing Rick Rubin there, aren't you?
Rick Rubin, that's yeah, it.
Creative,
yeah,
he... the creative act.
Yeah,
it's a brilliant, brilliant read. I got it last year. There's about, I don't know, about 150 chapters, but they're all about 4 pages in length. But they're so captivating in terms of the message. Especially for people in the creative industries. But yeah.
So yeah, it's good. It's a good one. Yeah. And it was in an interview. I can't remember who's interviewing him, but, and I'm sure he said it multiple times, but that quote specifically around the role of the artist, just very interesting and inspiring, and very much, I think, plays into the discussion.
Yeah. And I think he talks a lot about planting seeds as well. In the sense of, like, not every seed will grow, not every idea will flourish.
Yeah.
And again, it's a process. Like, the creative act is to just simply plant the seeds, and over time, some of those ideas will develop, and others just won't. They won't resonate with you, or they won't resonate with the time, or with the opportunity, with the project. No, he's an inspirational guy. And I would recommend our listeners to definitely look up his titles. Were very much worth a read.
Yeah.
Sasha, I think we have slightly overran today, but it's been an incredible conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. How can our audience stay in touch with your work?
Follow us on LinkedIn. That's where we're most active. If you look at Future Proof Fashion, you'll see the projects that we're currently working on. Yeah, that's where you can engage with us if you're interested.
Perfect. I'm sure lots of our audience will be doing just that. I'd just like to say, whether you're a creator, a builder, or a player in the digital world, have fun and enjoy being at the frontier of technology that is definitely changing the future. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.